Listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hello, and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, December 19th, 2025. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble.ca shares with you the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. Well, folks, it has been a very eventful year in Canada, to put it simply. As Rabble editor Nick Seabrook and publisher Sarah Sahagian noted on last week's show, Canadian politics went through one of its most dramatic periods in recent memory, including a federal election that shaped the national conversation. And politics were only a part of the picture. Environmental challenges, major labor actions, and Canada's shifting role on the international stage all kept the news cycle moving. Throughout it all, Rabble's reporters and freelance writers worked to make sense of these developments on our site and here on the podcast. Today, we're sharing the last episode of Rabble Radio for 2025. And in the fashion of our last episodes of the past few years, we're highlighting some of our best interviews of this year on Rabble Radio. Will your favorite make it on the list? Be sure to let us know over social media which episodes spoke to you the most this year and who you're hoping to hear on Rabble Radio in the year to come. Without further ado, let's dive into the top interviews on Rabble Radio in 2025. On March 9th of this year, after Justin Trudeau's resignation, Mark Carney was elected leader of the Liberal Party and became Prime Minister. He immediately called a snap federal election for April 28th, and this election was dominated by debate over newly imposed U.S. tariffs and President Donald Trump's threats of annexation. The election resulted in a Liberal minority government under Carney. A week before Canadians headed to the polls, Nick Seabrook spoke with Charlie Angus, former NDP MP for Timmins James Bay, about the resistance, a Canadian movement opposing Donald Trump, fascism, and rising threats to democracy. Here is a small clip of that conversation.
The morning after the Trump election, I knew that everything had been upended. And I also felt that we really needed a frame, an analysis, a way of speaking about this to understand the historical significance of this moment. So I started speaking up. I spoke in Parliament. I started the Charlie Angus Substack, and it just exploded because I think people understand that this is a moment unlike anything else that we've seen in our lifetimes. And a lot of people are worried that, you know, the sort of the political class doesn't see the seriousness, or just they don't want to confront the fact that we are now dealing with the rise of fascism on an unguarded border. And what does that mean for Canada? What does that mean for the world? And so I've sort of been thrust into this role of being a voice and of people reaching out to me. And so we started touring, speaking in communities from Nanaimo on Vancouver Island, Edmonton, across Northern Ontario. We were down in London, Toronto, and I'm getting requests to travel everywhere because people see this as a moment, but they see this also as the need to create a movement of resistance to defend democracy and the rule of law in Canada.
Now, you mentioned members of the political class not necessarily wanting to face the reality that we're in with Donald Trump. Whenever Trump started his career, he was, you know, sort of buffoonish, kind of a clown. Not a lot of people took him seriously. But as the years have gone on, things have become more serious. Obviously, he's leveled significant tariffs on countries around the world, including Canada. He also has made many statements about wanting to annex this country as a so-called 51st state. So how are you convincing people that what he's saying he is serious? Because it does seem so unthinkable that our neighbor that we've been friends with for so many decades, centuries, is all of a sudden now a threat to our sovereignty.
What has been really amazing And I don't really have anything to compare it to. Is it the resistance in this country really began with ordinary people suddenly saying, wait a minute, that's not going to happen. I'm not going to let that happen. I think the political leaders attempted initially to downplay Trump. You know, Prime Minister Trudeau went to Mar-a-Lago. Daniel Smith went to Mar-a-Lago, but I think for different intentions. I think Prime Minister Trudeau thought he could, you know, be the Trump whisperer and everything would be okay. And instead, it made Canada seem weak. And then the threats got worse. I'm very much of the belief that if Canada hadn't taken a super strong position, that the intimidation and the threats of annexation would increase. But we've seen across the country incredible resistance. The boycott is without precedent. People are really determined to defend their country. And I think they're going to hold their political leaders to account if their political leaders don't stand up and defend our country as well.
And you have been talking on this tour with a lot of Canadians across the country. What are you hearing most often about what they're wanting to see from their political leaders and what they're wanting to do as acts of resistance against the U.S.?
It's not just that our country has been threatened, but we're watching the rule of law disintegrate south of the border. The kidnapping of people, arbitrary detentions, attacks on universities, the whole-scale gutting of the American government institutions from health to even their spy agencies. We realize what happens if we let the conspiracy rage machine get their hands on power. It certainly affected Pierre Poilievre. I mean, it's an unprecedented drop of like 20 some points in the space of 2 months. Good on him, because he's driven this rage anger machine very much like Trump, and Canadians have said, no, we're not going to put up with that. What's really important for us now is to seize this moment of coming together in a way that I haven't seen people come together before across the country, across regions, across even political lines, that we make the most of this and we say that we need to actually make Canada pretty much a shining beacon for resistance. And I'm not bragging when I say that the rest of the world is watching Canada. We have become the front line of defense to Trump, not the Democrats, not the U.S. courts. It's Canada and it's ordinary Canadians. And that's something really incredible to witness.
The influence of Donald Trump's politics and subsequent rise in anti-immigrant, anti-trans, and anti-feminist rhetoric in Canada in 2025 cannot be overstated. This year for Pride Month, Nick Seabrook sat down with Devin Matthews, the head of programs at Rainbow Railroad, an organization dedicated to supporting 2S LGBTQIA+ folks across the globe, and Rama Esulani, a newcomer to Canada, originally from Morocco. Esulani shared with Seabrook their story of migrating from Morocco to Turkey to Canada through the help of Rainbow Railroad. And Matthews explains how, since the election of Donald Trump, more and more calls for help are coming from the United States. Take a listen.
In Morocco, I cannot be myself. I was so much suffering, facing discrimination, persecution, violence through outside to wear what I want to wear, to be as lesbian, queer, non-binary, to even to find a job. It was very hard for me. Through outside, it's very hard for me. Always that calling by assaulting from the society, from the people. Plus that I was being forced to be married to a man, so that is the reason, the main reason why I escaped from Morocco to Turkey, because it was like the end for me. I cannot do that, so that's why I escaped. So when I went to Turkey, it was worse than I thought. Also the same thing and worse. I cannot bear myself finding discrimination everywhere outside the street, at work. I faced violence from homophobic devised me, and I was hospitalized in the hospital, and the police did nothing just because they stopped me in the streets. Sometimes, are you a boy or girl? Start like that, and then they start beating me. So everywhere I contact, I try to be myself. And at the end, I was hopeless. Almost I'm going just to give up. But always I was have this hope, just I have to fight. I cannot live no traditional culture or religion or community can stop me, because I want just to be myself. So at the end, my hope and my dream and something inside me this is what makes me empower and give me energy that I cannot give up. And so Rainbow Road picked me up and we contact with each other and they came to Canada.
As mentioned, Rainbow Railroad's work isn't limited to countries on the eastern side of the world. In fact, the organization has seen a rise in requests for assistance from within the United States, particularly following the re-election of Donald Trump.
The United States has been a country that we have supported many people to relocating into, especially during the course of the last administration. And with varied success, we had numerous government partnerships and different programs to support people at a community level as well. We've since seen the infrastructure of those pathways, specifically around refugee resettlement, crumble under the current administration's policies. And a general anti-LGBTQI and anti-refugee and immigrant sentiment within the administration, which we were anticipating, just perhaps not at the rate or the extent that we have seen. We worked through the last time that this administration was in office and did what we could to support people through. And there are people who still manage to find some form of relative safety for themselves in the United States, despite any administration. And where those people are in the U.S. without support or find them their way to the U.S., during this time, we're running a program called Communities of Care, where we're bringing community members in the United States together to help support asylees and refugees who are in the United States, kind of orient themselves to the position that they're in, their rights environment, and how to access critical services. And so, yes, we've seen huge shifts from January until now, some of which we were anticipating, some of which have come for various reasons as a bit of a surprise. But at the end of the day, we will always do what we can to support people both inside of the United States, but more importantly, globally, in finding other options, especially those who were bound for the United States as refugees, who we now have to find alternative options for.
Another top story of the year globally was the ongoing genocide in Palestine. This was a major story across Rabble's podcast network this year, as well as written coverage on the site. In July, Nick Seabrook spoke to Dr. Yipeng Zhi, one of over 4,000 people from around the world who joined the Global March to Gaza. The Global March to Gaza attempted to reach the Rafah border crossing between Egypt and Palestine, aiming to draw global attention to the blockade of Gaza and call for an end to the siege. Here is a small snippet of their conversation.
Now, obviously, participating in something like this is, there was risk involved. It's a significant commitment of time and resources on your part. Why did you feel it was important for you to participate in this march?
I think personally for myself, as someone who's studied the impacts of colonialism on health in the context of Canada affecting Indigenous First Nations, Inuit, Métis peoples, that's what led me to the question of Palestine. And having also witnessed the conditions of apartheid and occupation in the West Bank, and then having volunteered in primary care clinics as a medical volunteer in central Rafah in Gaza during this genocide, I know that the solution for the people of Palestine is ultimately liberation. And it's through these meaningful solidarity efforts to end the siege and the blockade and the occupation and the genocide. This is the solution. Like it is international solidarity efforts in coordination and in direction with what Palestinian voices and narratives are telling us from the ground, to be able to use all the mechanisms necessary within our toolbox to be in full solidarity with the Palestinian people to end the conditions of occupation and genocide and apartheid. And we really take that kind of direction with seriousness and with a strong conviction for what we need to do in this moment. And we need to do everything to be able to prevent and end genocide. We've utterly failed as an international community, with the obligation really on states, on different states around the world, to end and prevent genocide. But that has utterly failed the people of Palestine because of those systems of oppression, namely Zionist colonialism, imperialism, and capitalism that make this genocide a profitable one. But the people of conscience around the world, I think, refuse to put profits over people, to put these interests above the people's right to self-determination, liberation, dignity, the right to life. And so in understanding this, when we have that privilege and that opportunity and the resources to contribute to a solidarity movement in this way, I think it means that we must. And so it just became really clear to me that this was something that I needed to do, not only for the people of Palestine, but also for myself, right? I think that people have said, do you really think that you folks, or like you as a person, can change the world? And one of the things I think back on is some other people have also reflected on this. It's not about changing the world per se. It's also not letting the world change us and the ways in which we see the world and the values and principles and the morals that we have. And so we will continue to mobilize and organize to do what we can for the people of Palestine as they experience an ongoing genocide. But we also know that the liberation of Palestine and for Palestinians also comes from their actions, their resistance, their resilience, their steadfastness on the ground. But it doesn't absolve us of the responsibility in the West in particular, when our states, our governments are the most complicit in this genocide, as they, for example, Canada continues to send arms and weapons, normalize relations with Israel, and continues to provide diplomatic and political cover for Israel.
One series we had on the show this year was on Ontario Premier Doug Ford's education agenda. One major concern raised again and again, Bill 33, the so-called Supporting Children and Students Act, gives the Minister of Education sweeping new powers to supervise school boards and mandate police presence in schools. In September, before the bill had received royal assent, Rabble editor Nick Seabrook sat down with David Mastin, president of the Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario, to talk about this bill and the current issues students and education workers are facing. Here are Mastin and Seabrook.
Our schools are struggling right now. They're struggling. There's not enough supports for our students that are most in need of those supports. We've got a lot of students for a variety of reasons that are struggling with mental health issues. And I don't want to get into that because it's very complicated, very deep. But the reality is our schools need to provide resources to help students reach their best, to provide an opportunity for every child to succeed. And some of our children are not succeeding right now. This government, since being elected in 2018, has systematically underfunded education to the tune of about $6.3 billion over the course of the last 7 years, which equates to about $1,500 per student since that point. And if you think about a class of 24, and that's on the low end, 35 on the high end, having $1,500 per student taken out of that system, think of what we could do differently on in a big picture level to provide the supports that our students need. So getting to your question, this systemic erosion of funding, I believe, is all a very calculated project by this government to create a crisis, to create a system that doesn't work, to drive parents out of the public system, to take their public dollars into the private system in order for ultimately this to be handed over to private capital. It's a $30 billion a year industry that private capital would love to sink their wallets into and get access to. And, you know, again, if Doug Ford wants a fight on this one, we're going to fight him on this one, because we know that a strong public education system is necessary in order to provide for the best for every child, regardless of family income. It's what we believe.
Now, you called it a manufactured crisis, and that's something, a tactic that we've seen from other governments that seek to privatize public services. We've seen it from this government in its attempt to privatize parts of the public health sector. What is the goal behind privatization? Why do they favor privatization over a well-funded public system? Who benefits from that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a multi-step response to that. I think certainly this government, and I would suggest all conservative governments, they lead and they serve one constituency, and they serve the business class. So I do believe that there is that part of it. I also believe that depending on which conservative and how conservative the government is, there is an underlying desire to get government out of the lives of citizens. And that libertarian perspective where people should have the right to choose everything and government should be out of the way is a form of conservatism also in government. And I also believe that this government has a fundamental understanding or belief that if you don't have the means to provide a certain level of service to your family, to your children, then you shouldn't have access to high quality things. So I think there's a multi-step answer to this, but I have yet to meet a conservative government anywhere that doesn't try to erode public services, hand them over to private capital for a variety of reasons. I don't agree with any of those reasons because I do believe there are certain things that every individual should have access to at the same level, and education and healthcare are at the very, very top of those lists. If we can't provide every child an opportunity to succeed, regardless of your family means and financial means, then we're doing a massive disservice to humanity.
And in our last clip of the show today, we're hearing from Rabble Labor reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga and Gowri Srinivasan of the Canadian Council for Refugees. In October, the two came together to discuss the current state of Canada's temporary foreign worker program and the issues surrounding the closed work permit system. Here is a small bit of that conversation.
What is the situation for migrant workers in Canada right now? What are some of the risks that they're facing?
Well, the risks that are inherent in the work of so many temporary foreign workers are many that stem from the nature of their terms, of their status in Canada, because their status is temporary and because migrant worker status is tied to a specific employer, that they've been approved to come through a specific employer. They're in a power relationship where they can access employment, but they don't have the freedom of mobility that all other workers have access to. And so they are in a very different power relationship with their employer, and it makes it much harder for them to critique, in addition to those, to critique any of the current, you know, work conditions that they have. So that sort of structural built-in dangers and risks that migrant workers face currently. But on top of that, there is a very worrisome climate in Canada. So migrant workers are core members of our community, and they are essential pillars of many sectors of our society, from the care economy and healthcare and long-term care to agriculture and fish processing to retail, grocery, the food system. So they are essential workers. And yet we have seen in the last 18 months to 2 years a climate of increased scapegoating of migrant workers and significant shifts in the program and in the policies that are relevant to them that make their status more precarious in Canada and that really shut down their options for pathways to permanence in Canada. And so I'm talking both about a shifting narrative that we hear from federal, provincial, and municipal leaders, as well as from many commentators and pundits, that has falsely blamed the crisis of cost of living and a crisis in housing to the existence of temporary foreign workers and temporary people with temporary status. So we've seen wholesale attacks in this narrative on both migrant workers and international students. And with this shifting narrative and a feeling, therefore, of increased precarity and vulnerability for many migrant workers, we are seeing new legislation tabled. So we have Bill C-2, which was tabled last June by the federal government, which is ostensibly a bill called the Strong Borders Act to address border security. Canadians have legitimate concerns about illegal weapons, about illegal drugs. But this bill kind of masking as a bill that will look at dangerous goods and providing, you know, enforcement agencies with the powers they need is in fact a really big grab, a shocking new grab for kinds of powers and authorities that are about bringing a more militarized approach to how we enforce borders. And for any worker who may fall out of status, this bill would bring in new powers for governments to track where people are and to compel service providers to give information about who is accessing services and to really restrict access to protection for refugee claimants. And to generally provide a lot more budget and military power to CBSA for removals. So in this context, people with temporary status and or people who may be falling out of status soon because their work permits may not be renewed, face increased fears for their safety. And ironically, from a bill which is supposed to be about increasing safety for people in Canada. So we have great concerns about current trends, both in programs and legislation, but also in attitudes in Canada and what that means for temporary people of temporary status in Canada, including long-standing this long-standing program of temporary foreign workers and what it means for their rights.
What an amazing year of guest speakers and interviews on the show. If you'd like to revisit and listen to the full version of any of these episodes, be sure to visit rabble.ca/podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. And once you're done there, visit us on social media and let us know what interview stood out to you the most this year and what guest you hope to hear on Rabble Radio in the year to come. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week and this year. Thank you as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Follow us on social media across channels at RabbleCA. Also, Rabble is in the middle of our winter fundraising campaign. If you'd like to share some care this holiday season, please consider becoming a monthly donor or gifting a one-time donation to Rabble today by visiting rabble.ca/donate. Thank you to every single journalist, writer, activist, artist, and organizer who contributed to this year's content on rabble.ca. Thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. And finally, the biggest thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio every single week this year. Rabble Radio will return on Friday, January 9, 2026. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next year.